Accession number 6820, room number 5.
Mr. Mackenzie, reel 5.
We'd hardly recovered our breaths when somebody opened up on us from the far side of the orchard. Only the fact that there was an 18-inch rise leading up from us, from the road into the orchard, saved our lives. Whoever had this automatic on the far side was probably fifth columnist. And I tried to locate him, but couldn't work out his position in the far hedge of the orchard. Until I got fed up and ordered Anderson to traverse down the far hedge when that particular jerry packed up until it got dark. That was the start. And the offensive opened up from there. We had a real broiling day of it. The artillery laid on a barrage of the wooden front. Our Roddy Graham with his mortars, he piled in, and the Germans, moving forward, were just blasted out of it all along the line. They were trying to come out of the wood and uphill without any immediate cover. The planes themselves, the jerry planes that were moving around and attempting to bomb us, were kept well up by B Company's riflemen who were lined out along the hedges, firing straight up into the air. And they did a very good job. And we weren't particularly, there were a lot of bombers about, we weren't particularly pestered with them. That seemed to be one ploy they didn't like. All day long, the battle raged. One, they tried to come in from our right. When that didn't work, they tried to infiltrate from the left. And they caught it from both sides. There was a tremendous amount of Germans killed that day, which didn't displease our particular lot. And by the end of the day, there was a certain amount of elation in the fact that one was still there after all the attempt to get us out of it.
Had the battle gone on for 24 hours?
No, this particular one hadn't. It was during the course of the day, from the time we'd marched into that village in the morning until we received orders, I suppose about 9 o'clock. Around about 8:30, the Germans started to infiltrate Tommy gunners, into the orchards in France. And as it got dark, the jerrys in front of my particular section set a steading on fire, and of course it wasn't all that to their advantage because it gave our people enough light to find the targets. I sent up a runner to the company headquarters and had news that it was the Germans retreating from that area. By this time there was about 20-30 Tommy gunners in the orchard in front of me, and I sent the runner back again to tell the company commander that there wasn't much chance of holding that position for very much longer. Company commander came down, had a look at the state of affairs, and tore off. Came back with orders that were to pull out at once and move further back up the village. Now, I had to warn the two sections on the right, collect them, move them back, get the section that I was with and my spare numbers, and move them up the road, which we all did, and off we went. We tore up through the village and collected under Lieutenant Broad, Richard Broad. He evidently had orders about the evacuation. I joined him with my men and under the PSM, and we tore up through the village just in time to pass the company commander rounding up the few men who were to remain in the village as a rear guard, and under his command. Moved up to the T junction, turned right, and through an absolute stream of machine gun bullets coming belting into the battalion headquarters. A strange thing that none of us were hit on that exodus. Moved out of the village to the left, halted, saw the Germans coming over the far ridge. They had a method that we weren't used to. They were firing what appeared to be an ordinary blank or cartridge of some sort that put a red light out, just like a tiny little fireworks. But they were doing this in such a manner to make a pattern as show the way to go ahead. This wasn't usual in the British Army at that time, but it might have developed afterwards, but it was certainly effective. And they weren't keeping quiet at all. They were making a lot of noise, and most of it was the shouts of Hitler. Shan't forget that in a hurry. Lieutenant Broad sent our DR, a chap called Harmsworth, down to recce the nearest crossroads.
What was his name?
Harmsworth. He was our particular DR, and he disappeared down there. We had his motorbike going down, and whatever happened, I think he must have run into Jerry's and took a different route. We didn't wait very long in that position. Lieutenant Broad decided that he was going to take a different route from the one that he'd been ordered. He took us all over the hedge on the side of the road, straight across the field. I know we had a couple of lots of barbed wire to negotiate that was crossing the field. I don't think it was defensive wire. It might have been splitting fields, but it was fairly tricky. We followed Lieutenant Broad until he took us out onto the main road, having gone that and that way.
How do you mean?
He'd cut in to the left, he turned at a right angle, and continued straight ahead over these barbed wire fences, and he'd struck the main road. So he must have either thought about it, or being a good intelligence officer, he had worked it out off a mat. He certainly took us in the right direction, and the DR had gone that way, and something happened to him here. I think he abandoned his bike and tried himself to get across the field. Richard Broad, he'd done that way and stuck the main road. So
the DR had gone at right angles to him?
The DR had gone down the road, and at the crossroads, the Jerry's, He'd heard Jerry's or seen Jerry's or suspected Jerry's, and he'd got off his bike and scarpered. Now, it's a funny thing when you're marching by night, you're never very sure that you're on the right track, especially if it's strange country. But we marched all night long. The whole night long, we marched. And, of course, behind us, the village was in flames, the Jerrys were screaming blue murder, and we thought our rear guard didn't stand an earthly chance of getting out there alive. It really was retreat from Moscow stuff, you know, 1812. Looking back on that, and it was a wonderful show, but we kept going, and we got back through Blangy. It's a town that we'd marched through on the way up into the attack on the Somme. We came through Blangy, up the slopes, and at the very last, I'd collapsed with my feet had been giving me tremendous trouble up to them. I'd managed to sort of forget about them, the excitement, I suppose. But I eventually collapsed, and I was only a few hundred yards from the forest. And Richard Broad, he helped me to get into the forest. So that I didn't think I could make it. However, his kind words got me on my feet again, and they helped me in. Now, this was the forest we'd left just a few days earlier, Blangy Forest, or as the French call it, Haute Forêt d'Eau, the EU. And we got in there, and I got my... Oh, I had a couple of my lads take me up to the top of the wood where the MO had got his truck, and showed him my feet. When I took off my socks, the whole skin of my, the sole of my feet seemed to come with it, an old pus. And Captain McKillop, the medical officer, he said to me that I'd got the start of trench feet, which didn't please me very much. He hadn't, he said, got anything very much for me, but he'd got a dipper. I don't know if you have ever heard of a dipper. It's a thing, they dip water out of the old-fashioned coppers. A short handle and a bowl.
Like a ladle.
That's right, yeah. He's got one of those full of methylated spirit. You just try that, which I did. And I put both feet into this dipper, sitting at the bottom of a tree. And I nearly hit the top of the tree. It was the most dreadful sensation, the raw meth on my raw feet. But that saved my life later on. And I was sitting on a row of blankets, and I, at this time, at the bottom of this tree, and looking at a pack in front of me with a tin hat in it, chucked on top of it, chap's equipment, it? And a nice hole in the front of the steel helmet. And I realised that I was sitting on the owner, wrapped up in a blanket. He'd been shot coming out of one of the villages as we were moving back. A fellow who was married to one of the Dover girls in very much the same way as I'd married mine. Well known to Hanlon, Tommy Hanlon. Or Johnny Hanlon. That's, by the way, as I say, we had marched all that night long, and the MO said to me, well, I put you on an ambulance. And I said, no, thank you, not to this stage. Because there was always a rumour, and it was almost every day, hail, rain or shine, that we, next day we were going to go in reserve, we were going to pull out for a rest or something like that. Never happened, but it's amazing that you always had faith in the next day. Well, at any rate, I didn't want to leave my chaps. He said, John McKellar, he said, well, you better have a day in the truck. You better move to the next stage and buy trucks. Would you get a seat in one of your fighting trucks? I said, oh, yeah, I think I'll be all right. So give me a chit for this, for the next stage. Then I went down, reported, and there. I took what cover and I could find and settled down to pass the day. Because I was particularly worried that my pal, McIntosh, son McIntosh, who'd been left behind on the rear guard, that he would have been caught. We didn't think there was a chance of getting clear of that village as we, you know, when we looked back on it. And there was about halfway through the morning, Tosh Julie turn up. McIntosh, he got a section of his platoon with him, and he was going up this hill, and he got a great, beautiful red setter. He'd got on a leash. It looked so comical coming out of that inferno. And there he was. So I gave him a wave, and he pulled in as soon as he saw that there was C Company there. And he said, I've got a bottle of rum. He'd liberated that on the way, and so that helped a bit, his rum. And of course I was so terribly relieved about it. He was a chap that had finished his service, was you know, his 21 years service, before the war broke out. He was a grand soldier. We were great pals. His own platoon commander was Lieutenant Hugh McKenzie. Strange enough, my father's name was Hugh. And he was a very young officer, very happy under the conditions out there, and always looked after his men. Taught a lot of McIntosh and was very popular, and was eventually to die in a German prisoner of war camp, McKenzie. That's, by the way, one loses the thread.
You had got the ride on the truck.
That's right. Left off. I was down for a ride on the truck. All that various rear parties were coming in, and it's amazing that the morale was terrific, really, despite the fact that everybody had gone through so much. That was the thing that impressed everybody. The story was that we're moving down and would possibly be moving out by Dieppe. That was the story. But, of course, we were only just really getting the news of Dunkirk, which had happened on the 4th. And that was you know, something we could scarcely grasp. But we'd quite determined that we'd fight our way through if we had to. You know, if there's any surrounding, and that there was that possibility was looming very large. The possibility that the Jerrys would get round to our front, the way we were going, get between us and Rouen, or us and wherever we're supposed to be going. And that's actually what was to happen. However, that particular day, I cheered up quite a bit. I didn't put my boots on all day long. I kept my socks off and I stuck my feet out so that the sun could get at them. And I felt morale returning quite well. I was given a seat on one of the trucks when the transport pulled out, and we went off from the forest down through a valley and eventually came to a little place between there and Dieppe called Ville Labat. And that's V-I, I'm not quite sure it's one L or two L's, Y. I think La Ba, B-A-S. I waited. The transport pulled in there and got in below the truck. There was an awful lot of planes about. Got in below the truck, went off to sleep till the battalion came in. They marched in the morning, and by this time I had my boots and that on, and found my company and my platoon. I discovered that the company sergeant major hadn't been wounded the previous day, or the fight at the railway line. He had been followed by my PSM, Platoon Sergeant Major Hollis, Davy Hollis. Now he was there and then promoted to Company Sergeant Major, or was appointed to act as Company Sergeant Major. And I took over the platoon for 15 Platoon C Company there and then. I cheered up quite a bit then. We weren't very long then in that position. Daylight came, there's plenty of planes about. There seemed to be planes as far as you could see them. But
German planes?
German planes, there weren't any British. And they seemed to be all over the place. But we had an RASC troop carrying column turned up at Ville Labat, and we just raced out of the little village place, farmsteads there, and onto the trucks and away. And we went from there into Dieppe, or the outskirts of Dieppe. Now, one of the comical things, despite the fatigue of the chaps and how they felt, they were singing all the way, because the story was that we're going to get a chance to get out of Dieppe. And we passed, or near enough Dieppe, we began to pass Beaufort's anti-aircraft gun. Of course, the lads were giving them the kayak. We hadn't seen anything in the nature of a real anti-aircraft weapon. We had our own brain guns on stands, but we hadn't seen a Beaufort up at that time, from start to finish of our part of the war. And there they were, bold as brass, all lined out round the pylons and guarding these ruddy pylons. The Beaufort, you can imagine what the jocks were calling, you know, "Where the hell have you been?" and so on. However, the artillery seemed to take it in good part, give us a wave. We moved into Dieppe. The heights above Dieppe had a camp of Nissen huts, these rounded huts, which had been built to house German prisoners of war and had been evacuated but a few days previously to get the Jerrys out of it when they knew that we didn't have much chance of staying there. And, we marched in there, into the camp. I was given one of the huts and got my platoon all bedded down. No lights. We'd hardly, I suppose, about an hour's sleep when some clown went all round the corrugated iron with a hammer, running it all round. Of course, the first thing when we awoke, we thought the tanks were in, so there was a bit of shouting and yelling until we realised what had happened. This chap who'd been on patrol, he found me, said I'd got to go and report to the company commander.
What did he run the hammer across the corrugated iron for?
To waken us. It was a very noisy, rude and unkind method of waking us. But he wasn't going to come in a dark hut and start waking everybody up. He probably did the right thing, but it was very unnerving because it was just as though a whole battalion of tanks were in the top of us. And we had more tanks than we'd wanted up to that moment. I went to Major Money, and he was almost as tired as I was. And he said I'd just been given orders that we had to hold dear, that we were moving out at once. I'd got the men up and dressed. The company was moving down to the main road into Dieppe. There is a railway line runs alongside. And we marched out and down in the pitch darkness. We couldn't do anything about finding a position. We just sort of established ourselves on or behind a wall which edged this road